Chapter 5. Sizing Up Foes. Dogger's Shack was among the worst ale halls in Scar Harbor, and the owner, Dogger, liked it that way. The age-grade wood of the walls and floors only got washed enough to get the occasional splatter of blood off, but the tables and chairs were always near to new, though of the cheapest make that could be found. Fights were regular to the point of almost being expected on a busy night, and the furnishings took a beating, or were used in dealing one out. It was a place where a man with one eye and a few rotten teeth could go to drink with his social inferiors. The regulars ran the name of the place together as Dogger's Shack, and could tell anyone who did not belong when they used two words to name it. Foreigners were not unheard of in Dogger's Shack, being right near the water where newcomers first set foot in Acardia after getting off the boat that brought them. Some stumbled in by mischance, often to their dismay. Others sought it out with purpose, for the same two reasons the locals did. It was a place where ruffians might still find welcome, and piss-poor ale still got a man drunk. The door was jammed open with a bit of driftwood to keep the stink of the place manageable, and let out the heat from hot, sweating patrons on a warm, late afternoon. Folks came and went all day, so it took something more than passingly unusual to draw attention. The lot that entered that day qualified. They were preceded by a woman, Keshi by her look, with a short mop of yellow hair and a few tiny braids hanging to one side. Her eyes were so deep a blue that they looked nearly black. They flitted back and forth as she swept the room appraisingly before passing the threshold. She was tall, comely despite her stern look, with youthful pale skin, probably even had all her teeth, and thin limbs. Her most womanly features were obscured by her leather armor, close-fitted, but still vague enough to leave hungry eyes guessing at the shape beneath, and the loose black tunic thrown over it only made things harder on the lecherous eyes, sizing her up like the day's catch. The armor was Keshi-styled, with a steel neck guard running from collarbone to collarbone, with the front left open. Her arms were left bare. They bore no scars despite being left exposed by her armor, which might have been taken as a sign of being untested in battle, if not for the tattoos. Keshi warriors of a certain mindset had tiny circles along their upper arms. Each circle represented a coin left on the body of a slain enemy, ostensibly to pay whoever found the body for the trouble of disposing of it. It was not a tradition among soldiers, who might leave a wounded foe and never know his fate, or who might range about the field of battle for half a day, killing and avoiding death's pursuit. Of old, it was the sign of an assassin, so that none might mistake the crime for an accident or a fit of anger or passion. In more modern times, mercenaries wore the marks as a sign of prowess, some in the old way of the assassins who might even leave coins as tradition would dictate, while others would brazenly take on far more than they had ever killed. To wear Keshi armor open-sleeved, with dozens of the markings showing, was a braggart's boast, without even having to speak a word. Gazes followed gazes, and men looked to see what had captured their drinking companion's attention. Nudges and low, ribald comments alerted the rest, until nearly the whole of Dogger's Shack was watching her. Having deemed the place suitable by whatever low standard she must have had, she turned her head to look back at her companions, and gave a sideways nod inside to beckon them. First in behind the Keshi girl was a tall, wiry Acardian, with a sword at his hip. He had a face that looked permanently punched, with a large brow, flat nose, and a large chin like a small child's knee jutting below his mouth. He had a mean glint in his eyes and a languid ease to his movements, the sort that blustering youths try to imitate when they want to look tougher than they are. Right behind him was a black-skinned Tikalish warrior. He wore a patch over one eye, and had a scar running down the jaw on the other side, partly obscured by his beard. There was light aplenty in the tap room, otherwise his features would have been difficult to discern, with the black-on-black contrast of his skin, eye patch, and beard. The white of his one good eye shone starkly against the brownish green of the rest. If the men in Dogger Shack that night did not know that his long twin beards dangling down over his gray-trimmed burgundy tunic marked him as a warrior, the Tikalish half-spear sheathed on his back made it obvious. The Tikalish had decided that the bit of swords nearest the crossguard were not worth the trouble of sharpening. Instead, they decided to shorten the blade and lengthen the grip. The weapon was lighter than a greatsword, but with just as much reach, and their warriors had learned to use the lengthened handle to grasp the half-spear at different points to change the weapon's reach, striking force, and blocking ability. It was no weapon for a novice. The last to enter was a hulking bear of a man, not much taller than the Keshi girl. He might have outweighed her thrice over. His greasy black hair and beard were wild and unkempt, obscuring much of his ruddy face and making his wide blue eyes seem a bit unnerving. He had the look of a madman, and it was a convincing enough act to cause wariness, even if it turned out he was feigning. He wore a voluminous tarp of a sweat-soaked blue woolen tunic over a shirt of chain that looked to be custom-sized to his massive gut. He kept two swords at his hip. One looked expensive, with a jeweled pommel and crossguard, while the other was shorter and more utilitarian. The quartet was obviously well off by their gear and the jingle in purses as they walked in. Dogger Shack was a rough establishment where a lot of bad things could happen to folk who walked about with too much coin on their person. However, being a rough establishment, it contained a lot of men who knew the difference between snagging an easy mark and getting run through by trying to rob a coin blade. The Keshi girl headed straight for the bar, while the others bullied free a spot from a couple of dockhands who were not making full use of a table that sat four. The crowd parted for her, at least enough so that she might try to shoulder her way past those in her path, rather than confront them. There was no shortage of foul-smelling drunkards that would not mind even so little attention from her. "I am looking for a man," she told the barkeep after sizing up none other than Dogger himself, working at the taps. She spoke Akkadian well, but there was enough of a Keshi accent that it made her sound exotic, with the drawn-out vowels and lyrical intonation. A small chorus of volunteers spoke up immediately, vouching for their own manhood and offering credentials. One was even so bold as to take her by the arm and run a thumb along her kill-marking tattoos.
"Pretty thing like you ought."
The rest of the man's insights and advice were lost to the world as the Keshi girl reached across and grabbed his wrist. At the same time, she lifted her foot and gave a sharp heel kick into the offender's knee. As the knee buckled, with a sickening crunch, the wretch screamed. The girl twisted his wrist until she was free of his grasp, and then used her newly freed arm to push him solidly to the ground, flipping him over the leg that had just kicked him. The lecher hit head first, and lay there moaning until she twisted again, breaking his arm and setting him off screaming again. She let his arm fall limp and stomped down on his head, silencing him. Whether he was unconscious or dead, none could tell.
"Sorry, reflex," the girl, Soria, said to Dogger.
"Some of you lot, drag this feller out of here. If in he's breathing, leave him out back. If in he ain't, pitch him into the harbor. I'll gut any one of yous with a ladle if I get any truncheon sniffing round here after him,"
Dogger ordered. Anyone who hung around Dogger Shack got used to it after a while. Dogger could not go two breaths without making some sort of threat. Soria herself had never been to Scar Harbor before, possibly as a babe when she was too young to remember, but she puzzled out that truncheon must have been the local slang for the city guards.
"You look like you've got some coin. You better after that little stunt. Ought to push those two pretty little ears of yours together for that," Dogger said.
"As I was saying, I am looking for a man. His name is Kairos. I heard he lived here in Scar Harbor," Soria said, ignoring the colorful image Dogger had just sketched out for her. of her head squeezed flat until her ears touched.
"Ne'er met him. Set of the cannonballs dangling from his yardarm for sure, though, knitting off with the harbinger like he did. Filleted himself two truncheons, was watching over him in the pokey. Burnt down a ship and aft the docks. Folks say he's a witch," Dogger spat. "I ain't for knowing spit about that. What I know's that a fella you floor stomped owed me for 30 eccles in drinks and ain't paid up. I'm for thinking you owe for that."
"If you can't rein in your patrons, that hardly seems my problem. If he hadn't paid, you should have had someone search his pockets before dumping him in the Katamic," Soria shot back.
"Didn't think of it at the time. I was more feared of bringing the truncheons into the place about it than I was of picking the pockets of some rough salt with his lamp blown out by a keshi bent with a leaking spigot. I ought to knock your skull in and pass yous round like a hat at a juggling show to take up a collection," Dogger said.
Soria could not help herself and laughed at the absurd thought.
"You're thinking this is a lark, eh, Miss Mercenary Arm Twister? This lot's like a family. They'd gut and clean you if and I said some keshi quick hand was stiffing me on a tab," Dogger said.
"I do, and I doubt it." Dogger offered a rueful smile.
"Heh, you might be right at that," he said, and chuckled,
taking a liking to a lass who could weather his worst storm and laugh about it. The bar keeps a useless blowhard, but he knew where the witch worked. Apparently it turned into a bit of a gawk spot, and everyone in town knows about it, Soria explained to her companions as she joined them at the table. She took the ale they had procured for her and took a deep swig. Arguing was thirsty work.
"It's something at least," Zell said, then shrugged. "I was hoping for something more to go on than a building. Someone to talk to and question, that sort of thing."
"Scar Harbor is big enough. There will be plenty of people to talk to. Someone will know him better than the barkeep at the first place we tried," said Rakashi, nursing his own ale.
The Takalish was used to much stronger and more flavorful liquors, and he only pestered his ale to keep up appearances.
"Gotta say, Soria, the keshi look suits you better than a guardian,"
Tanner said as he looked her over playfully. "Keep mentioning that every time and I'll need to start putting another little circle tattoo on," Soria said. She had been fending off half-hearted advances from Tanner since she had known him. It had disgusted her when she was a girl of 15, and he was 8 years her senior. Now it was just annoying. The jest had teeth, though. Magical disguise or not, the count of circles on her arm was correct, as best she remembered it.
"Huh, get an eyeful," Zell said, then gave Soria a gentle backhand slap on the shoulder to get her attention.
She broke her glare at Tanner and looked where Zell's attention had fallen. Nailed on one wall of Dogger Shack were a number of sketches. There was writing below each, but across the taproom, it was too small to read, and the sketches too indistinct to identify anyone by them. Without saying a word, Soria stood and crossed the taproom. After the incident at the bar, no one got in her way. They were bounty postings. She scanned through the pictures until she found the one she knew had to be there. Her heart quickened in her chest when she looked at it. The text below read, "Kyrus Hinterdale, wanted for witchcraft, murder, and piracy. 300,000 eccles for his return." The words may have said it was Kyrus Hinterdale, but when she saw the crude picture, Soria muttered under her breath,
"I found you, Brennus."
Soria had appropriated the sketch of Brennus, or Kyrus as she would now have to struggle to remember, and shown it to the others. She had told none of the others of her suspicions that the reported sorcerer found in Scar Harbor had been Brennus Soloran back in Cadran. She wanted to surprise everyone, and to make sure she was right. The picture had set her mind at ease on the last count, at least. Though the artwork was unimpressive, and it had been reproduced on a printing press, it was clearly him.
The four of them, Soria, Zelasan, Rakashi, and Tanner, had taken up rooms at a much nicer inn far from the dock district. Noblemen's estates might overlook the sea, but the closer you got to a working port, the seedier and more dangerous the accommodations became. For all their dangerous looks, Soria and her companions had the coin to spend on comfort and enjoyed using it. Safely in her own room, she allowed her appearance to shift back to normal. Gone were the blonde hair and two blue eyes. The skin on her arms returned to its smooth, unmarred state, with no tattoos, and a shade darker than she had made it. A subtlety no doubt lost on the ruffians at the dock and the rubes in the city. Soria prided herself on thoroughness in her disguises, though, and took care in case one among the unwashed pack was worldly enough to tell northern Keshi from southern. The little braids in her hair she had woven that morning on the ride to town, and rather taken a liking to. The brown beads woven into them stood out less against her natural auburn color, so she doubted anyone would mistake her for the same girl who had stormed through Doggershack. The armor was her own, Keshi made and well molded to her form in the years she had owned it. It left her arms free to fight, and acted as more of a safeguard in case her magical shields were ever lacking, or she was caught unawares. That would certainly be noticed, should she go about clad in it in Scar Harbor as Soria Coinblade, rather than her Keshi alter ego. She stowed the armor away until they were ready to leave the city. The accent she had used had taken no magic, nor any special acting on her part. She had spent much of her youth in Kesh, and spoke Keshi better than her birth language of Akkardian. She could drop the accent when she had to, but it took effort, and she slipped up when flustered. Usually she did not bother to try to hide it, since many foreigners found it charming. Weary and sweat-caked from traveling and wearing armor about, Soria took advantage of the amenities available at a nice inn like the Little Manor, and had one of the maids draw her a bath. She tipped the lass a 20-eckel coin and made the girl's day. The water was hot, and Soria was intent that it remain so. It might not draw suspicion in Kadrin to have a cold bath drawn and heat it to taste by means of ether, but in Akkardia, she waited the extra time for the girl to bring the water hot. Should it begin to cool, Soria planned to use enough ether to keep herself warm for a long time. She soaked in the little tub for hours until her legs cramped and her bottom began to lose feeling from sitting on hard metal for too long. It was well past midnight, but Soria was accustomed to late nights and not yet sleepy. As she relaxed, she unfocused her eyes, drifting into ether vision and seeing the world in swirling blue-white ether, with little sources all about, slumbering. The ether being less than compelling enough to hold her interest, Soria let her mind drift a little more loosely and slipped past the ether vision to watch through Juliana Archon's eyes. Rakashi drew curious glances as he walked the streets of Scar Harbor the next morning, after splitting off from the rest of the group. They had gone their separate ways after scouting the neighborhood around the witch's shop and talking to his neighbors for leads. Takalish were not unheard of in Akkardia, but visibly armed folk always drew more attention, even than that of the constables that roamed the city like watchdogs on an overlarge estate. Many Takalish merchants brought their goods to Akkardia through Scar Harbor, and some had even settled in the city. The merchants wore flashy clothing, bright jewelry, and funny little hats, to Akkardian thinking at least, that told the enlightened shopper what guild they were affiliated with. The conservatively dressed Takalish with the eye patch and war braids bore watching. He walked about the city, passively taking in the sights he had never seen before, as it was his first time in Scar Harbor. He had a task to accomplish, but there was almost no chance that the sorcerer they were looking for was still in the city, so the urgency to find him was scant. It felt good to be away from the others for a while. He loved them as brothers and sister, but they were often loud and rash. Rakashi preferred time to think before speaking, and to speak before acting.
Soria was the worst in that regard. She thought quickly and felt that it gave her leave to act on any whim, counting on her wits, or at worst, her magic, to save her. Rikashi made his way generally in the direction of the Society of Learned Men, but wended his way via the side streets and thoroughfares that bore only the slightest hint at his destination. Tanner or Soria might have done the same out of some paranoid sense of diversion, and Zell would almost certainly not have taken such an oblique route at all. But Rikashi liked to see the world he lived in, not just survive it and profit from it. He looked into shops to see what sort of things the Akkadians liked to buy and how they dealt in business.
He met the gaze of passers-by with a slight nod and a hand to his chest, the standard Tikalish greeting between strangers who have nothing to discuss. He even stopped on two occasions to give 5 ekel coins to beggars and inquire after their health. By the time he had arrived at the Society of Learned Men, it was a proper time to take lunch. After introducing himself to the Society's manservant as a traveling scholar, he was invited to luncheon with Professor Honothan Whitegull, whom Kairos Hinterdale's cobbler neighbor had claimed was a patron of the scrivener's shop from time to time. "It is so rare for us to have armed guests at the table, Rikashi, old boy," the professor commented. Stooped and gaunt, with a fluffy fringe of white hair about his head, he was hardly one to be commenting on his guest's age. "I travel much, just as a merchant ship carries cannons or a diplomat travels with men at arms, so I carry my half-spear. One day I may have a nice position in a university as you have here in Akkadia, but I must earn my way first. And just like a merchant or a diplomat, my travels may take me places that are not so friendly," Rikashi said. "Might I have a look at it?"
Professor Whitegull asked politely,
peering over Rikashi's shoulder at the handle of his weapon. "Of course," Rikashi replied smoothly, drawing the blade and setting it down gingerly next to the professor's plate. He was not normally of a habit of handing over his weapon in an unfamiliar setting, but no man who served cucumber and minced pork finger sandwiches as lunch was a threat to take up his blade against him, no matter his age or apparent infirmity. The old man gave the half-spear an appraising look and ran a fingernail across the blade to see the mark it left.
"Very nice, very nice. Good workmanship coming out of Tikalia these days, it seems. You keep a good edge on it, too. Looks about 12 years old, to judge by the condition of the leather on the grip. It ought to last another 12 at least before it needs any serious repair."
"I use it gently. I have never killed with it," Rikashi indulged in the pleasant lie to keep the luncheon more congenial.
Not every non-warrior was comfortable in the presence of one who had killed.
"Twice in my travels I have been accosted, but never have I had the misfortune to shed my attacker's lifeblood. Most of the nicks and the marks you see upon it are from practice. It takes years to learn to use a half-spear well, and the learning keeps the body in good health."
"So what brings you to Scar Harbor, sir?" Professor Whitegull inquired.
"I am looking for a man named Kairos Hinterdale," Rikashi told him, glad to have the professor broach the change of subject so that he had a proper reason to bring up his search. "I have heard that you did business with him."
"A bit, yes. Mostly with his former employer, though, expert chartler. Kairos seemed like a good enough lad. You know, quiet, bookish, professorial. One of my own kind, so to speak."
The professor chuckled lightly at what he must have found to be an amusing observation. Rikashi did not patronize him by pretending to understand the jest, but merely listened respectfully.
"Anyway, that whole witch business is a bunch of poppycock. Magic does not exist. If folk were less inclined to their cups, there would be fewer troublemakers claiming it did."
Rikashi nodded through the professor's little tirade, as if to agree with all he was saying. With the ether vision in his patched eye, however, Rikashi could not help but notice that the drawing room in which they ate contained no fewer than 3 items imbued with ether. The Society of Learned Men were either better collectors than they realized, or someone among them was more learned than the others.
"Well, whether he is a witch or not, I hope to find him. I would very much like to meet a witch if they exist. If they do not,
I would like to see what sort of man would earn such a reputation, Rakashi said.
Be a bit off by most folks' reckoning and have the misfortune to be around some odd happenstance that a drunken mind might not wrap itself fully around. By my best conjecture, in the absence of any personal connection to the facts, that is most likely what befell Expert Hinterdale, Professor Whitegull pontificated, pontificating being a special privilege of academia. Satisfied that he would find little of practical use in speaking with the professor, Rakashi instead spent the afternoon in a stimulating discussion of foreign politics. Zella-san had eaten a hearty breakfast in the common room of the little manor, but was intent on another morning meal with his choice of investigative subjects. The witch had apparently been friendly with one of the local bakers, and Zell was planning to sample his wares if he got naught else from his assigned task. Gruder's Pastries was a tidy little establishment, not a bad walk from where he had just parted ways with the others. Apparently, the Hinterdale fellow was a regular customer and friend of the proprietor, so Zell was going to see what he could learn about him. Business was brisk. There was room to move in the little shop. There were tables filled with late breakfasters, and a small line waiting at a counter to purchase sweets to take away. They were city folk, peasant merchants, and tradesmen from the look of them, with night workers predominating the lot of them, if Zell was any judge. A large man to begin with, Zell stood out all the more for being armed in a bakery in a rather safe little Akkadian seaport. The docks might have had pretensions of roughness, but the interior portion of the city stank of sweets and flowers. Zell played nice and waited his turn in line. Despite a number of customers in front of him, it did not take long before he made his way to the front. There was an admirable efficiency to the operation. He hoped the food was admirable as well.
"What would you like today, sir?" the baker asked,
when Zell was left with none between him and the counter.
"You know a fellow named Kairos Hinterdale?" Zell asked, skipping to his reason for coming without preamble.
"Haven't got any of those today. Try a scone, perhaps,"
the baker replied without pausing so much as a heartbeat.
"You Gruder, ain't ya?"
Zell said, not to be dissuaded by an impertinent baker.
"If I'm not, I've been doing him quite a favor running his bakery all these years," Gruder replied. "Now are you going to buy something? I have customers waiting, you know."
Zell glanced over his shoulder and noticed that there were indeed people who had come into the shop behind him while he was not paying attention. It was the sort of mistake that could get him killed in a place like Darkwater or Marker's Point, but Scar Harbor was the sort of place that lulled one with its idyllic seaside charm. The name made it sound a bit rough at the edges, but the scar it referred to was just a sandbar that cut through the harbor on maps and looked a bit like a facial scar, if you were a cartographer or navigator with too much imagination, who stares at maps all day, seeing in them shapes and objects like children do pointing up at the clouds. "Give me two of those little puffy ones and two of the twisty ones. Oh, and I'll have one of them big cream-topped ones too." Zell picked out whatever looked tastiest, a hard task since it all looked and smelled wonderful. He waited a breath until Gruder was busying himself about wrapping up his order, then set back in on his main line of questioning.
"So you know this fellow Kairos the Witcher, don't you?
You another purveyor of justice for hire, then, I take it?"
"Close, but way off," Zell answered, not even realizing the paradox.
"You're a friend of his, I hear, so I think I can give you the back alley on this one. I'm a coin blade, and I could use a fellow like him, if rumors be true. Only a madman would go chasing a witch if he meant to do him harm. So either this Kairos is a witch, and I'd be crazy to tangle with him if he was, or he isn't, and I got no use finding him or trying to hire him. So now, since I'm playing cards up with you, how about you tell me this? You think he's really a witch, like they say? If any is, any help you can give me finding him is no trouble to him. Either he likes my offer or he doesn't. No one has taken a witch to jail twice. Even once is probably fool's luck."
Gruder gave Zell a hard look. He was near to Zell's size, but not quite. and there was far less hard muscle under his own fluffy outer layer than the coin blades.
86 eccles, sir, he replied evenly.
Zelisan fished in his pockets and slowly counted out no less than 200 eccles, then a few more for flair, and slapped them down on the counter. Gruder started to hand him his purchase, but noticed that Zell was not moving his hand from atop the coins. It was a simple enough question, Zell stated, looking Gruder square in the eye with as little menace as he could manage to keep from mustering.
All right, then. Yes, I think Kairos pulled the hat down over our eyes and was a witch all along. He was a good lad, though. Amiable, pleasant, thoughtful.
But a bit of a wit to him.
Never had I heard a word against him until suddenly they said he was a threat to everyone. Do I think he attacked constables who sought to arrest him? Of course. Back a spinster's lap cat into the corner, and it will remind you that it still has claws.
It is your fault for forgetting.
And provoking it. It defended itself the only way nature provided. If they had left Kairos alone, he would still be working at his shop, bothering no one.
Fair answer. Sounds like a man who could use a new home. Somewhere folk respect that everyone's got claws of their own. Where you think he might head, in case someone wanted to see about offering him work? Zell asked.
I doubt Kairos has ever been outside Acardia before, Gruder said, then sighed. If he has any sense in him, he should find a nice, quiet place to make himself a new home, and never be heard from again. At least not as Kairos Hinterdale. If he has somewhat less sense, he might have headed to Golas. His mentor lives there now as scribe to King Gordon. I could see why he might try to have him intervene with the king. Of course, if he has no sense at all, Gruder amended, looking away as if pondering, he might sneak back to Scar Harbor to whisk away his lady.
Your friend always been the sensible sort, would you say? Zell asked, smiling amiably.
Thoughtful, perhaps. Smart as a kick in the shin. But sensible. Couldn't rightly say.
Of course he drew the docks. It was the most dangerous assignment of all the places they meant to ask around about Kairos Hinterdale. Zell looked toughest of them all, and Rakashi was no clean-bladed virgin. But Tanner had magic to fall back on if things turned that special reddish version of ugly. He was no proper sorcerer like Soria, but he could manage to cast the shielding spell in the morning, out loud, since he could not manage silently like she could, and keep it going weakly as he went about the day. He would be fine so long as he did not doze off or become too distracted by something and let it lapse. And if he got into trouble, he could draw a bit of ether to strengthen it.
Soria, that quick-talking horse merchant. She should be the one down here badgering longshoremen,
Tanner groused internally. Anyone could walk around the docks as they pleased and not worry too much. It was when you started asking lots of questions that you had to watch for knives out of the corner of your eye.
She wouldn't even have to threaten or bribe them, more than likely. Pretty things like her can just lick her lips and sway her backside, and this lot'd tell her anything and not know it.
Tanner caught himself and tried to remember to leave Soria's backside out of his thoughts. Her little threats used to be cute when she was a lass. He would comment on her womanly assets or accidentally walk in on her in the bath. He was getting the growing impression, though, that his leash was being pulled taut, and that the next thing he said that offended her might be his last. That fellow in the bar had not been half so forward as Tanner had been on more than one occasion, and she nearly killed him. It was as friendly a warning as he was likely to receive from her. He eased himself into his task by making casual talk with a few of the locals. They were a pathetic lot, and were more informed about parochial matters than what transpired in the greater world around them, despite working at one of the major entry points for foreigners visiting Acardia. They had all heard of the trial of Kairos the Witch, though, and one even claimed to have been there, but none had heard of him since his escape from jail. It seemed to be common wisdom down by the waterfront that Kyrus had fallen in with the notorious pirate, Denric Zane. Zane had escaped the New Hope penal colony shortly before Kyrus Hinterdale's trial and was unaccounted for, up to the point a Navy ship was commandeered under bizarre circumstances. Folk claimed that the witch had used magic to swing a gangplank about,
knocking Navy sailors into the harbor as they fought to reclaim their vessel.
Then one of the ships nearby had been set ablaze, burning a fair bit of the piers with it. Tanner was impressed. If half what the longshoreman told him was true, then this Kyrus fellow was a true sorcerer. Soria knew her business when it came to magic, but she trusted to her fists or daggers when trouble came, not fire and telekinesis. It sort of raised the question of just how Kyrus Hinterdale had gotten himself stuck in jail in the first place. He was either new to sorcery, which would have made the feats described to Tanner all the more impressive, or he had been trying to avoid confirming everyone's suspicions that he was a witch. Of course, it was also possible that the longshoremen were having a lark with him, spouting fishermen's tales when it was nothing but a simple daring raid on an understaffed Navy frigate. Tanner finally found some more worldly sea folk to talk to. Many offered ill-mannered suggestions about his parentage, gender, looks, or skin, but a few were willing to talk over free ale, which Tanner grudgingly supplied. He had a better plan than asking about some accused witch whose fame likely ended at the water's edge. Instead, he talked to them about the pirate.
"Yah, Zane, I heard of him," one thick-tongued mongrel garbled in response to his query.
The man chewed some pungent mash of roots that bulged one side of his mouth.
"He crew his ship at New Marker Point. I think of going too, but bad leg, you see."
The man flexed one leg as if to prove it gimpy, but Tanner could see nothing wrong with it.
Coward or liar, more like.
Tanner did not challenge him, though.
"They say where he was headed from there?" Tanner asked. "No, that I heard. Was a big powder explosion. Burned down lot of houses. Lot of ships left after that. Zane's ship left too. Nobody liked to stay and get blamed, maybe," the man said.
"How'd they know it was a gunpowder and not just a fire?" Tanner asked. He had a hunch.
"There was a big boom. No lamp oil or cooking fire make a boom when it burn," the mongrel answered.
"Maybe Marker's Point ought to be the next place we look,"
Tanner thought. If he could burn down ships, maybe Kyrus Hinterdale could burn down houses, too.
"I'm starting to wonder if this fella's gonna be worth the trouble he causes if we do convince him to join us. Winds, maybe we don't wanna take the chance of him, not caring much for our offer."
Tanner did not like the idea of fighting a real sorcerer.
"Why did I do this to myself?"
Soria asked herself for at least the dozenth time as she strolled across Scar Harbor, with a tranquil, aloof smile painted over her face.
"I should have traded with Rakashi. He's more delicate with these sort of things anyway."
Soria Coinblade had been left behind at the little manor, and she had gone as Darla Silverweave instead. Darla was far from her favorite persona, but it was one that seemed appropriate for the day. She wore long, honey-blonde tresses, tumbling front and back of her shoulders in ringlets, and had turned her eyes a striking blue. The curls were from a ratty old wig she kept for long-haired disguises, magically tinted to whatever look suited her purpose. It was a comfortable bit of her disguise, having had it for years. The dress was less comfortable. Juliana was accustomed to dresses, but they felt weird and awkward to Soria, Darla, and any other name she cared to take. Her muscular thighs rubbed together for lack of the proper undergarments to accompany her attire. She was not a pack mule to be carrying all that fine ladies would wear as she traveled. The warm spring breeze tickled the tops of her bosoms, which were left open for the world to see in ways that armor never would, nor her traveling gear. There were times when Soria looked into a mirror before going out in disguise and could feel no connection to her reflection. Kajitala, her southern Keshi persona, had never seemed so alien to her as Darla, whom she had copied from a Herlin nobleman's daughter that she met once. Bright blue eyes looked unreal to her. Dark Keshi eyes had looked at her most of her life, and her own darkish green ones looked back at her often enough in reflections. Her figure seemed foreign to her as well. Her muscled arms lay hidden below a wispy layer of delicate pink fabric, and the lacings of her dress pulled it tight at her waist, making her hips seem wide when she really had very little of them to speak of. The low cut in front, and some trick in the making of expensive dresses, made it appear that she had the bust of a grown woman, rather than a newly flowered maiden. She had almost changed her mind before leaving the little manor.
"I lie better than any of them do. I can just say I got no useful information, or make up some banal blather, and take a strong liking to some lead one of them turns up."
In the end, though, curiosity drove her out into the streets dressed as a lady of wealth and style, the latter being more a hope of hers, with little fashion sense of her own to count upon. Soria purchased a parasol from a little boutique on her way. With only a small handbag to carry, her hands itched for something to do, and she knew it would not be ladylike, whatever her idle hands did while she lost track of them. She was liable to end up cracking her knuckles or tugging at the awkward-feeling bits of her dress, possibly something worse. Doubts nagged at her as she crossed the city.
"It does not mean anything. I would bet heavy coin that Brannis did not even know of the connection until just recently. Whatever his twin did, he did it on his own. What works in one world works in the other."
She reminded herself of the rules of the twin-born, as taught to her by Rikashi. She had known of Juliana since they were little girls together, but if Brannis had just met his twin, it would take time for them to learn from each other. Soria sat a horse better than any Keshi-raised city girl had a right to. Juliana would give a good accounting of herself in a Tikalish dagger fight, despite being a spoiled princess of a sorceress. If someone were to shout Juliana across a crowded room, Soria's head would turn. It would only be a matter of time before Brannis and his twin shared the same bond. Soria kept on wrestling with her own thoughts and decided thrice to turn back, only to find her legs had dutifully kept her on a steady course as her mind had wandered halfway to Kadrin and back. She finally arrived in front of a studio door. A painted sign above showed a brush and palette, colorfully painted. The sign was not carved at all to stand against weather and still proclaim its message as wind and rain faded and wore the colors. It was a sign of a cheap sign.
"Nothing to be done but do it," she told herself firmly.
Soria knocked on the door. She heard muffled voices from inside, followed by footsteps. If it were not already squished tight by her dress, her stomach would have clenched with nerves.
"Good morning,"
a comely young girl answered as she opened the door.
"Celia."
The thought struck Soria like an arrow to the heart, but the sensation passed.
"No, but close enough, I think."
Celia Mistfield had been newly appointed as one of Juliana's least favorite people, ever since she had turned up after the Battle of Rainsdark and started trying to woo Brannis away from her. The girl was built the same as Celia, at least, middling in height, certainly not so tall as Soria, but with an ample bosom and hips that did not need a tailored dress to prove their presence. She had the same dark hair and blue eyes, but Celia's face was more angular. Celia's eyes were also less bright and more cunning than those of the young painter who had just greeted Soria.
"Good morning,"
Soria returned in kind after a pause that was just on the borderlands of awkwardness.
"I understand that you are an artist. You have been recommended."
Soria spoke airily and with as accordion an accent as she could manage. Her brain was feeling just a touch fuzzy, and she hoped it was piloting its course well enough without both hands upon the wheel.
"Please come in. I shall be just a short while longer. I have a sitting this morning, but I can get you a chair if you don't mind waiting."
The artist, Soria knew her name was Abelay Tillman, but stubbornly refused to acknowledge the fact,
was saccharinely pleasant in her manner.
Her voice sang better in conversation than Soria or Juliana could manage in song when truly trying. Soria tried hard not to hate her. She followed the artist inside the studio and took the proffered seat once it had been dusted off. Soria folded up her parasol and set it point down against the floor like a cane, holding it with both hands, lest her idle habits embarrass her. She had made a concerted effort to unclench her jaw, which she had not intended to clench in the first place, working it side to side a bit when no one was looking in order to relax the muscles of her face. The studio had one other occupant, a gentleman of perhaps 30 years of age, dressed in his feasting day finest. He was seated upon a small wooden stool near the window, well illuminated by the morning sunshine. He was a dashing fellow, with curling hair that hung to just below his jaw, and that framed a face with bright brown eyes and a determined nose. Halfway between Soria and the gentleman was a canvas showing a striking likeness of him, rendered in colored oils.
"Thomas Harwick, m'lady, it is my pleasure," the gentleman introduced himself when he noticed Soria looking at him.
He was smiling as he said it, apparently taking her casual interest for less than casual interest, or at least being in the habit of often thinking such, and reacting flirtatiously by rote. "Darla," Soria replied, startled from her mind's wandering to the point where she caught a bit of Keshi in her own introduction. Composing herself quickly, she tried again. "Darla Silverweave. Feel free to have a look around as you wait. If you like, you might even assure Mr. Harwick that his portrait is nearly finished,"
Abelay, the artist, said, not turning from the canvas to which she had returned and resumed her work.
"I have not let him see it yet. It is unseemly for a man to see himself half finished," she jested, smiling.
"Merciful one, dimples."
Soria let her eyes sweep around the small studio. Every space along the walls was taken up by paintings, not hung, but rather leaning against the walls. Most were portraits, but a few landscapes and seascapes were mixed in. On a whim, and with nothing better to occupy her time, Soria looked into the ether. The dashing Mr. Harwick seemed ordinary enough as sources go, and the artist girl seemed robust and healthy, but nothing special. She noticed a necklace that the girl wore. It was some cheap jade thing that they sold far and wide in Kesh, and shipped by the crate to foreign lands where they would fetch better prices. It was the sort of stuff jade workers gave their apprentices to practice on. The artist was wearing one that had a bit of ether in it.
"Where did you learn to do that little trick, Brannis?"
After an uncomfortable half hour of forcing herself repeatedly to try to relax, the sitting was finally at an end. Thomas Harwick was overjoyed at his likeness and promised to send a servant by to collect it later that day. Soria had muttered some platitudes to keep in character.
"So, Lady Silverweave, thank you for waiting. How may I be of service?" the artist asked cheerfully. "You can tell me where Brannis is and save me the trouble of beating the information out of you."
"I was hoping you might paint a simple portrait for me," Soria said instead. She reached into her handbag and removed a scrap of paper. It was the bounty notice of Kairos Hinterdale, with the written part at the bottom torn off, leaving just the sketched image.
"I have made inquiries, and I have come to understand that you knew the subject of this crude likeness."
Soria saw the girl's smile falter.
"Aye, m'lady. Put it away, please, if you would not mind so much. I could paint expert Hinterdale from memory well enough, should I wish to. If you do not mind my asking, what is he to you?" the artist asked. "Aha, the first sign of jealousy, eh? He was mine before he knew you existed."
Soria had done her scouting, though, and had everything prepared.
"My father is a dear friend of expert Davin Chartler, to whom expert Hinterdale was once apprenticed. I understand that they were quite close, and expert Davin has taken hard the awful news to have come out about expert Kairos. The portrait would be a gift to him."
Abelais' suspicious demeanor melted like chocolate left under the summer sun.
Oh, that is so kind of you.
I have a talking duck I can sell you as well, Soria thought. How does this girl run a business being this naive?
Have you any news of Expert Hinterdale that you could share? Any word at all might be some comfort, Soria crooned,
hamming up her performance now that she realized how easily the girl was taken in.
No, but if you must know, he did admit to me that there was some truth to what they accused him of, the girl said sheepishly. Not that I believe for a moment that he meant anyone harm, of course.
If you believe he is a witch, why would you not believe he killed two men and escaped with a pirate? Soria prodded, having heard the same rumors and tales as most folk about the night Kyrus made off with one of the Navy's finest ships, reportedly in the company of Denric Zane.
I am sure he had nothing to do with that, the artist girl said, raising her voice. He might have escaped, but he did not do the rest of that awful stuff.
I think it just might be possible that you did not know him as well as you thought. If you truly ever loved him, he could tell you that all that happened is true, and it would change nothing. Consider for the moment that every bit of what people say about him is true. Consider that he killed men who wished him ill, and took the only means of escape at hand, making allegiance with a pirate. Could you still love him? Soria pressed, forgetting to keep the Keshi out of her accordion. Abelais seemed disinclined to notice.
Kyrus isn't like that. He told me that he had dreams of being a knight, Abelais said.
Then he wishes to be like that. That is the sort of thing knights do. Soria stabbed the verbal dagger into Abelais' heart. Feeling a twinge of remorse, she made a small alteration to her plan. She took some coins from her handbag. Here is 1,000 eccles, she told Abelais, having no idea how much portraits cost and guessing that it ought to be enough. Have the finished work sent to Davin Chartler, care of the palace in Golis. Paint Kyrus as you remember him, not as you have discovered him to be. Soria was sweating and dizzy when she left the studio. She had never expected the girl to have any useful information about Kyrus Hinterdale's whereabouts. But once she had learned that Kyrus had courted her, Soria had to meet her.
You obviously learned some things from my Brannis, Mr. Hinterdale. You are not figuring out magic all on your own, I would wager. You also obviously have a lot left to learn from him, though, if that girl was the best you could find here.